Syrians taste freedom.
For some, like Ahmed Al-San, visiting the Bakhtash ice cream parlor was a priority.
Excellent. I swear to God, I haven't tasted anything like it.
But will foreign influence or Syrians themselves decide their future?
The Arab uprisings of 2010, 2011, and other uprisings in various places have left pretty much four scenarios for what can happen.
Today is Wednesday, December 11th, and this is The Issue from VOA.
I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Lori London. Life is returning to normal in Syria in a way that hasn't been possible in more than 50 years. Amid the bustling open markets in old Damascus lies Bakhtash, a legendary ice cream parlor that has stood as a testament to Syrian heritage for over a century. While known for its unique Arabic-style ice cream, Bakhtash is more than a dessert shop. It's a symbol of resilience and cultural pride. Alice Rizzo with Reuters has the story.
This famous shop has been serving a much-loved Arabic-style ice cream for decades. But for many Syrians, years of civil war made visiting it impossible, until now. In the wake of Bashar al-Assad's ouster, tens of thousands of Syrians have returned to Damascus. And for some, like Ahmed al-San, visiting the Bakhtash ice cream parlor was a priority.
Excellent. I swear to God, I haven't tasted anything like it.
The secret to this beloved dessert, sahlab, a special flour made from orchid roots. The ice cream is pounded by hand with meter-long mallets until it becomes soft and stretchy. Topped with a generous coating of pistachios, it costs just $1. Co-owner Samir Bakhtash reopened the shop the day after Assad's fall. It was his way of celebrating the end of a government that oppressed Syrians for decades.
The shop is nearly 130 years old. The shop was established in 1895 by the founder of the shop, who is my grandfather, Hemdi Bakhtash. Of course, since 1895, this path was continued by my father. May God have mercy on him, and my uncle too, still present, being very old. Now we are the third generation of the founders of the shop. We are running the store, me, my brother, and my cousins.
He insisted the signature recipe had not changed since his great-grandfather came up with it in 1890.
That was Reuters correspondent Alice Rizzo. Syria's new interim prime minister says he aims to bring back millions of Syrian refugees. Thousands have already been lining up at the Turkish border to head home, and speaking of their expectations for a better life. International peace studies professor Mary Ellen O'Connell says the future of Syria depends on how much foreign interference there will be.
Reports say Israeli warplanes have pounded Syria at strategic weapons sites of the Assad regime as its troops advance deeper into the country. O'Connell says Israel's push into Syria could cause future issues with whatever government emerges there.
The United States is bombing. The United States has had troops stationed in Syria since the Trump administration. Those troops are in a very vulnerable, very dangerous situation. And this bombing that the United States has carried out quite extensively is only adding to the chaos.
White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby told VOA that whatever governance comes out of the process, Washington wants to make sure it meets the aspirations of the Syrian people.
What we want to see in terms of governance in Syria is governance that is seen as credible and legitimate, that is sustainable, that meets the aspirations of the Syrian people, and that is the result, the product of a Syrian-led process to get them to that point. I think it's too soon to know exactly how it's all going to unfold. I mean, this just really developed over the course of the weekend. So we're watching this real, real close. We are in touch with the opposition and rebel groups, all of them, in one way or another. And we are having conversations with our counterparts in the region. The president spoke to King Abdullah yesterday. There'll be additional conversations and visits by key national security leaders in the coming days to make sure of that.
For Syria's Kurdish minority, America's closest ally in the country, the struggle for a new order is entering a potentially even more challenging phase.
Now, the Turks have a valid concern, too, about security across that border. I mean, they've come under terrorist attack. And so we recognize that they have legitimate concerns in terms of the safety and security of people inside Turkey. We're going to continue to, and this is, you know, I know right now Syria's kind of coming to the fore because of the news over the weekend, but it's not as if we haven't continually, over the last 4 years, had conversations with the Turks about their concerns along that border, and quite frankly, sharing with them our concerns about what we're trying to do against ISIS, partnering with the Syrian Democratic Forces. So, look, where those two levels of concerns overlap or maybe conflict, we have the ability and have executed the ability to have conversations with the Turks to try to sort all this out, and we'll do that.
You know, there's a lot of pressure on Syria, Lori, not just internally with the various factions that are coming together in an attempt to form a new government and different backgrounds of the population, Christian, Muslim, and so on, Kurdish. But there's a lot of pressure, as you know, you just said, from outside on their borders, Turkey in the north, Israel, Lebanon.
Right.
Not to mention the United States and Russia.
Right. I mean, there's so many factors in play here, and this region is already sort of a tinderbox as it is. You don't want to downplay the joy that people are feeling, but at the same time, there is so much uncertainty. And of course, Turkey, you know, has been an ally of the rebels, and certainly not upset about the Assad regime, you know, being gone. But at the same time, you know, I think they're becoming more and more concerned about what Israel's planning here.
Sure. Right. Israel too. Right. Exactly. I got a chance to get some perspective on where all this could be heading with UCLA professor James Gelvin. His research focuses on the modern Middle East, particularly greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. Thank you so much for being able to take the time and talk to us today.
You're welcome.
So I want to start with the people of Syria. Many people have never lived outside of the Bashir regime, and a lot of people haven't even lived outside the civil war or were very young when the civil war started. And so they're waking up in a Syria that is foreign to them. And the number one thing I've heard from people is, I feel like I can breathe for the first time. Or the first time in a long time. It must be extraordinary after living under such a repressive regime.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at the Assads, father and son, the regime started in 1970. So somebody has to be fairly old at the present time to have lived under governments that were not Assad governments in Syria. Both father and son were extraordinarily repressive. The father was notorious for the 1982 massacre at Hama. And the son, of course, was responsible for getting Syria into the situation that it's in now. So put it together with the fact that about 25% of the population in the Arab world is below the age of 20. This is something brand new for many people.
What are some of the pitfalls do you think that they're going to face in the immediate future of trying to construct a new government?
I think there are three things that really they have to do. They have to, first of all, avoid retribution. There are a lot of angry people there, but we've seen that in other places that have tried to for example, repress people who were associated with the old regime, that they will fight back. And at the present time, the new government of Syria doesn't have control of the coastal region, which is filled with loyalists to the regime. So they have to avoid retribution in order to make sure that these people are not going to view themselves as under existential threat. The second thing they have to do is they have to avoid Islamic law. There are large numbers of minorities and liberal Muslims in the in Syria. It's one of the more liberal states in the Arab world. And there's going to be a lot of noses out of joint if the HTS attempts to impose Islamic law on society. There are minorities like the Alawites on the coast. There are Christian minorities. There are Kurds who, for example, are, as they all pretty much less religious than the others. So what they have to do is make sure that they can integrate all the people under a common secular law. And finally, they have to commit to decentralization. It's the only way that there's going to be peace in Syria, that there are whole areas of Syria that are outside HTS control. There's the Kurdish area in the north, the Alawite area, as I said, on the coast. There are areas that are controlled by other rebellious forces. There are the Druze, for example, in the south. So if they have a decentralized government, which is the opposite of what Assad was attempting to do, if they have a decentralized government, what they can do is actually bring all these people into the governing structure. Now, that being said, it's probably going to devolve into a situation that's a lot worse than what we have going on now.
In what way?
Well, the Arab uprisings of 2010, 2011, and other uprisings in various places have left pretty much four scenarios for what can happen. First of all, there is the Afghanistan scenario, which is that the Taliban came in and pretty much outlawed all the other political parties and opposed a very strict reading of Islamic law. That's not going to work in Syria at all. And there's a Libya situation, which is after the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi, a variety of militias took over various parts of the country. And what we have is warlordism in Libya, which is a possible future for Syria as well. Then we have actually a democratic experiment that's going on, the Kurdish experiment in the north, with the autonomous zone that they have there, which has not only a democratically elected government, but has gender parity on all levels of governance. This is very unlikely to take place in Syria simply because Syria is much more diverse than the Kurdish area. And the Kurds were facing an existential threat with ISIS. Finally, there are the national dialogues that took place in Bahrain and Yemen after the initial outbreak of the rebellions there. And those failed to resolve any of the issues that were on the table, mainly because people felt that what they were given at the end of a national dialogue was a lot less than what they deserved. So the most likely scenario is a Libya scenario, but we could always hope for something better.
You've also got some big players in the region and on their borders, Israel, Russia, the United States, Turkey. Particularly a lot of activity now on the Turkish border and the Israeli border and the buffer zone.
Yeah, basically, we could look at this whole question as being HTS was able to take advantage of a situation in which practically the entire axis of resistance has been demolished. The axis of resistance consisted of Iran, Syria, Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis. And at this point, Hamas is on the ropes, Hezbollah is on the ropes, the Houthis have been severely weakened as well. Iran can't really intervene because of its own problems, internal problems, mainly economic problems. Russia is involved in the Ukraine, so there's that situation there that Russia can't really get involved either. So they took advantage of this. Now, what you outlined is that something that's very important as well is that the reason why the Syrian rebellion took as long as it did to get resolved was all the proxy players that were involved. And Turkey was certainly a proxy player, along with the Gulf and along with Russia and along with Iran and so on and so forth. Now, Turkey, of course, is going to be a big spoiler for the Kurds in the north. Turkey's got its own group that it supports, something called the Syrian National Army, which is arrayed against the Syrian Democratic Front, which is a Kurdish front, the Army of Rojava. So the Kurds are under severe pressure now from Turkey, and Turkey's aims are to push the Kurds away from their border and to get rid of the refugees, the Syrian refugees that fled to Turkey. Then you have Israel, and what Israel's goals are in occupying parts of Syria on the extreme west is unknown at the present time. They took over the area that was demilitarized after 1973 war and went beyond the boundaries of that. And what they've done now is completely demolished the Syrian fleet and also have rendered a great deal of damage to the Syrian military capabilities overall as well. So Israel is looking at this as an opportunity, actually, to eliminate another member of the axis of resistance. So the final question is the United States, which really doesn't have is really not going to play very much of a role in this. Already Donald Trump has said that the United States is not going to intervene in Syria. The United States has no leverage over any of the players. And the best that the United States can do is to take the sanctions off of Syria so that this extraordinary poverty in Syria is alleviated. You have 69% of the population that is under, that is below the poverty line, and about 25% of the population that's in extreme poverty. Sanctions are only exacerbating that problem.
Mm. You mentioned Iran and its proxies. This is just another hammer to them. They've had a very bad year, haven't they?
Yes. I mean, it started out with, let me just clarify something to begin with, which is that Iran has fingertip control over some of its proxies, but not many of them. It doesn't have fingertip control over Hamas. It doesn't have fingertip control over Hezbollah. It doesn't have fingertip control over the Houthis, et cetera. As a matter of fact, Iran didn't know about October 7th, according to the U.S. Intelligence, until after it occurred. That being said, they relied on these various groupings as a deterrent for Israel. They've lost pretty much all of these groupings. I mean, Hezbollah, Hamas are just shadows of themselves at the present time. They're licking their wounds. They need time to do that. The Houthis have been severely weakened as well. So basically they've got real difficulties at the present time in actually deterring Israel, which is what its goal has been.
Likewise, it's been aside from the October 7th attack, it has been a good period of time for Israel in terms of being able to accomplish several of these goals, Hamas, Hezbollah, the border with Syria.
Yeah, certainly it's not deniable that this has certainly taken the pressure off of the Netanyahu government. The intelligence failure of October 7th has been forgotten pretty much in light of the various successes that the Israelis have had. The one thing we can't lose sight of, though, is the tremendous cost of those successes. Several thousand people have been killed in Lebanon, and large parts of the population has been displaced. In Gaza, for example, about 45,000 people have been killed in Gaza. Large parts of the territory have been reduced to rubble. There is famine that's predicted for large swaths of northern Gaza, for example. And disease that have been eradicated in Gaza are back. So the cost to the populations that are bordering on Israel has been immense.
Big picture, last question, big picture. The landscape in the Middle East has changed dramatically in the last 12 months, 18 months. Can you characterize what we've seen?
Yes. Before all the events beginning in October 7th, the largest cleavage in the Middle East, the biggest divide, was between Saudi Arabia and its allies on the one hand, and we'll include among them Israel, which has got things in common in terms of strategy with these various states. So that's on the one hand, and the axis of resistance on the other hand, which included Iran, Syria, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, etc. Now it appears that the Israelis have pretty much decimated the axis of resistance. That cleavage no longer exists, and so it might lead to a reordering of the Middle East along those lines. There is a problem, though, with what's going on in terms of the way things have pretty much ended at the present time, which is, besides the incredible human toll this has taken, the war goals of the Israelis are unreachable in terms of Hamas. They're not going to be able to destroy Hamas, which is the fundamental war goal. And this is one of the final aspects of the whole scenario that is not going to be put in place anytime soon.
Hmm. Thank you so much for the time and the knowledge.
You're welcome.
That was James Gelvin speaking with Scott. He's the professor of history at the University of California, Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's, and I think he's going to be probably right. His prediction is it's not going to go so well for Syria and the Syrian people, given the history in the region and similar regime changes. Particularly, as he pointed out, he thinks this is going to go the way of Libya.
You know, at least, you know, these people that have potentially been imprisoned are out of them. And some of them may be able to be reunited with their loved ones. Maybe the ones that are not, at least the families will have a little bit of closure from all of this and these horrific, torturous situations. Hopefully will be, you know, in the history books, if there's nothing else, you know, if it doesn't go exactly how they would like. And like you said, and he said, maybe the way of Libya, some of this horrific stuff is at least now in the past.
Well, certainly the upside, no matter what happens, is they're not under the control of the brutality of this regime, which is unmatched in the modern world.
You've been listening to The Issue from the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA and for all of our VOA people around the world, thank you so much for joining us.
You can follow The Issue on X and Facebook at VOA The Issue. And for news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, check out our website at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Lori London. We'll talk to you tomorrow.